One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Vietnamese officials have lowered expectations for their country's normally fast-growing economy in 2020. The officials noted that weakness in the international economy has reduced demand for exports and international travel. Vietnam's $260 billion economy has grown 6% or more each year since 2012 because of an increase in manufactured exports. Vietnamese officials say the economy will grow just 2% in 2020. That is down from an earlier target of 2.5%. The Asian Development Bank estimates that the economy will expand at a rate of just 1.8% this year. Experts say measures taken around the world to contain COVID-19 have reduced orders to Vietnamese factories that make shoes, clothing, and furniture. Stay-at-home rules in Western countries are keeping people away from physical stores. Business closures in those countries have left people out of work and less likely to buy non-essential goods. Frederick Burke is a partner with the law office Baker McKenzie in Ho Chi Minh City. He told VOA, "The rule is that those light industrial goods are weak, the exports orders are down, and there's reports of a lot of unemployment in the factory sector in the Vietnamese provinces." Vietnamese factories that make electronic products still get orders from companies that sell overseas to people working or studying at home. However, most factories that make non-essential goods are failing, Burke said. For example, one Vietnamese factory operated by a Taiwan-based company dismissed 150 workers earlier this year. That information comes from the nonprofit Business and Human Rights Resource Center. Vietnam has closed its borders to limit the spread of COVID-19. The border closure is stopping investors from making trips that would help them expand. They would normally travel to Vietnam from Japan, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan to search for new places to manufacture goods. Jack Nguyen is a partner with Mazars, a business advisory service in Ho Chi Minh City. He said that Vietnam's tourism industry has also been badly affected by the restrictions on travel. Foreign tourism usually makes up 6% of the Vietnamese economy. Things will only pick up only when the borders are open and there's no quarantine requirements, Nguyen said. Who knows when that's going to be?
Thank you.
At the pyramids of Giza, a few tourists walk among Egypt's ancient wonders. At Red Sea resorts, visitor numbers are well below what they were in earlier years. Coronavirus cases in Egypt remain under control, but officials, hotel owners, and tour guides agree that the tourism season, starting in October, is going to be difficult. That could be bad news for the economy. Tourism makes up to around 15% of Egypt's economy. Officials said the economy was losing around $1 billion each month after tourism mostly stopped in March. Since July 1st, 220,000 tourists have visited the Red Sea province and South Sinai, which is home to the Sharm el-Sheikh resort. That number represents less than 10% of last year's levels, said Rada Shelaby, a deputy minister at the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities. Egypt has asked the International Monetary Fund for $8 billion in new loans this year. Samer is a trader who has been working at the pyramids south of Cairo for around 30 years. We used to see about 50 buses here. Now there are none, he said. He has been selling his possessions to pay for his son's school fees. We only had one bus a week ago, full of Russians. They took some photos and left. Westerners often come to see Egypt's historic sites and golden sands between October and May. They want to avoid the cold at home and the heat of Egypt's summer. Shelaby said visitors are slowly returning to the resorts by the sea. But Shelaby said that safety was more important than increasing tourism numbers. I'm John Russell.
New measurements show that radiation levels on the moon are 2 to 3 times higher than on the International Space Station. The measurements were taken by an instrument on China's Chang'e 4 lunar lander. The spacecraft touched down on the far side of the moon in January of 2019. German and Chinese scientists involved in the experiment say the Chinese lander provided the first active measurements of radiation levels on the surface of the moon. The findings were recently reported in a study in the publication Science Advances. The study comes as the United States and several other countries develop plans to send astronauts to explore the moon. The American Space Agency, NASA, has a goal of landing the first woman and next man on the moon by 2024 as part of its Artemis program. It also wants to set up a long-term base on the moon by 2028. But space radiation presents major health risks to future astronauts. Cancer is the main health concern, but radiation exposure can also lead to other diseases. NASA has already warned that space travelers spending long periods in places like the Moon or Mars will face high levels of harmful radiation. Earth's atmosphere and magnetic shield protect humans from the extreme radiation present in the universe. But astronauts aboard the International Space Station receive more than 10 times the radiation that we receive on Earth. The new study suggests that radiation exposure on the Moon would be 2.6 higher than on the International Space Station. The researchers said astronauts on the Moon would get about 200 times more radiation than we experience on Earth. Robert Wimmer Schweingruber is an astrophysicist at the University of Kiel in Germany. He helped lead the research. He told the French press agency AFP the finding led his team to predict that astronauts would only be able to stay on the Moon for about 2 months under current conditions. Humans are not really made for these radiation levels and should protect themselves when on the Moon, Wimmer Schweingruber said. He added that radiation levels should be about the same in all areas of the Moon, except for near the walls of deep craters. Basically, the less you see of the sky, the better, he said. The researchers suggested that astronauts could build shelters made of moon dirt for protection during stays of more than a few days. They said the shelter's walls would need to be at least 80 centimeters thick. A wall thicker than that, they said, could cause the dirt to give off its own secondary radiation. Such radiation is created when cosmic rays interact with the lunar soil. NASA has said it will have radiation detectors and a safe shelter on all of its crew spacecraft flying to the Moon. Thomas Berger is a physicist with the German Space Agency's Medicine Institute. He also took part in the study. He called results of the experiment immense. The method finally gives scientists a data set that can be used to effectively measure radiation and study its effects on humans, Berger said. The radiation levels described in the study are similar to levels that models have already predicted. Carrie Lee is a space radiation expert at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Lee said the measurements agree nearly exactly with those made by a detector on a NASA orbiter that has been circling the Moon for more than 10 years. It is nice to see confirmation of what we think, and that our understanding of how radiation interacts with the Moon is as expected, Lee said. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time on our program, we talked about the election of 1840. William Henry Harrison easily defeated Martin Van Buren and became the 9th President of the United States. By that time, another political force was growing in the country. It did not come from Van Buren's Democratic Party, nor did it come from Harrison's Whig Party. It grew out of slavery. The dispute over slavery appeared to have been resolved for a time. A political compromise in 1820 kept a balance between slave and non-slave states. The compromise also barred slavery in the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase. But during the 1830s, the issue of slavery rose to the surface again. A major reason why the dispute came to life again was cotton. Cotton plants grew in many fields across the southern states. Black slaves planted, picked, and took care of the cotton crops. They also had other duties on southern farms. Northern ships then carried southern cotton to the markets of Europe. Manufactured goods needed in the south came from the north. The situation deeply troubled the political leaders of the South. They worried that cotton made their states economically dependent on the industrial North. What made things worse was the fact that most federal spending on public works projects went to the northern states. Then there was the old dispute over import taxes. Taxes on foreign goods mostly helped the manufacturers of the North. The taxes were to be lowered in 1842, but that was still years away. No one could be sure what would happen then. Such were the general political and economic conditions in the United States when the abolitionist movement began to make itself known. Abolitionism was an effort to end slavery and the slave trade. At first, religious groups organized the abolitionist movement. Then, in the 1830s, anti-slavery societies began operating in New York and New England. Many abolitionist groups published newspapers, pamphlets, and booklets. They flooded the country with anti-slavery petitions. Abolitionists believed slavery was evil and that there could be no compromise with evil. They did not like the idea that slaves should become free slowly over time, and they did not think slaveholders should be paid to free their slaves. They just wanted all slavery to disappear immediately.
They were regarded as this wild-eyed, fanatic group on the far left inside of the anti-slavery movement. People who were willing to do anything, radicals. They would upend society. This was the view that the people had of them.
Howard Jones is an historian. For many years, he taught at the University of Alabama. He says the abolitionists did not have much popular support. In the South, slavery was not a question of right or wrong. It was a question of survival. Some Southerners believed that without slavery, their whole economic system would lie in ruins. In the North, the abolitionists did not yet have major support. Some feared the abolitionist movement would weaken the rule of law. Even if they did not like slavery, these people believed the Constitution permitted it. As a result of the public feeling at the time, abolitionists struggled to communicate their message. Some states even sought to stop the flow of anti-slavery literature across their borders. In 1836, the House of Representatives declared it would not listen to any anti-slavery petitions. This decision became known as the gag rule. The Senate did not pass such a rule, but it did develop a complex, indirect method to delay action on anti-slavery petitions. Then something strange happened. Historian Howard Jones says some abolitionists believed the event was God's way of helping their cause. In August of 1839, a slave ship appeared in waters off the coast of New York. The ship was carrying two white Spanish-speaking men and about 50 men, women, and children from Africa. The captain was missing. American sailors stopped the ship and brought everyone to the mainland. No one knew what to do with the Africans. Were they criminals? Slaves? If so, who did they belong to? The Africans did not speak English or Spanish, so they could not explain themselves. The government jailed the Africans in New Haven, Connecticut, while officials tried to decide what to do. The slave ship was called the Amistad, and the case became known as the Amistad case. One of the leaders of the abolitionist movement, a man named Lewis Tappan, was very wealthy. Howard Jones says that Mr. Tappan sought to use the Amistad case to gain support for ending slavery.
What Tappan wanted to do was to use his almost unlimited financial resources to take these people to court, the Amistad captives, 53 of them, and show that they were human beings, that they had a right to be free.
The abolitionists found a free black man who spoke both English and Mende, the language of a few of the Africans. This translator helped explain what happened. The Mende said they had been kidnapped from their homes in West Africa. They were forced to march to the coast. There, white slave traders bought them. At that time, the United States, Spain, and many other countries had signed treaties to ban the international slave trade. The United States had also made buying slaves from Africa illegal, but the government did not enforce the law. A Portuguese ship brought the Mende and several hundred other captured Africans to Cuba. Many died of sickness, starvation, or beatings on the long trip across the Atlantic Ocean, which was called the Middle Passage. Those who survived were brought to a market in Havana. Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time. Spanish law said slavery was legal on the island, but the slave trade was not. To get around the law, many traders acted as if captured Africans had been living in Cuba as slaves for a long time. For instance, one of the young Mende men was named Sengbe Pie. Two Cuban middlemen bought him and about 50 other men, women, and children for farms on the other side of the island. The middlemen wrote his name in their records as Joseph Sinque. They gave the other Africans Spanish names too, so it would seem like the Africans had been born in Cuba. Then they loaded the group onto a ship called the Amistad, a name that means friendship in Spanish, and chained them below deck. Historian Howard Jones says the Amistad was like a taxi.
It would transport slaves wherever you wanted them to be taken. Now, they weren't really slaves. They had never been enslaved, but they were called that at this point. That's a critical issue in this whole thing.
A few nights later, Sengbe Pie and some of the other Africans broke free. They found weapons and waited until sunrise. The next morning, Pie and his shipmates killed the captain of the Amistad and the cook. Two crew members escaped. The Cuban middlemen were the only white people who remained. The Africans said they would let the Cubans live, but only if they brought the ship back to Africa. The middlemen agreed. During the day, they sailed the Amistad southeast, but at night, they turned the ship northwest toward the United States, hoping to arrive one day in a friendly southern port. Nearly 2 months later, the food and water on the Amistad were gone. Several of the Africans took a small boat to land to get more supplies. The captain of a government ship saw them. He brought the Africans and the Amistad into port in the northern state of Connecticut. The Cuban middlemen told their side of the story. They said the Africans were slaves who had revolted and claimed the ship's passengers as property. The Spanish government agreed with the middlemen. It demanded that the ship and the Africans be returned to Cuba. Spain's queen said that Spanish law would decide what happened next. Martin Van Buren, who was president at the time, liked the Spanish idea. He did not want to cause problems with Southern voters and politicians. He wanted to avoid the issue. But it was too late. The captain of the government ship said the Amistad and the Africans on it belonged to him. He said he had found them and he had a right to sell the Africans as slaves. The captain gave the middlemen permission to go, and he gave the Africans to the U.S. government to decide the case. The charges against the Amistad Africans were serious. They were accused of being murderers and pirates. If they were found guilty, they could be enslaved for the rest of their lives or put to death. But the abolitionists claimed the Amistad Africans were something entirely different. They said the Africans were captives who had been kidnapped illegally. The Africans should not be punished, the abolitionists said, but returned to Africa. Historian Howard Jones says the abolitionists looked forward to presenting the case in court. They also hoped Sengbe Pie and the others could help with their communication problems. They wanted the Amistad Africans to tell Americans what life in Africa was like.
But more important than that, what it was like on the dread African slave trade, that middle passage, those thousands of miles of crossing the ocean to the New World, and then, by extension, throw a dark light on what slavery was like itself.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.